This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Besides the screen you spent most of your time staring at this week, chances are you are also captivated by a big screen video installation. From billboards to scoreboards, we inform and entertain audiences with our big screen solutions. Visit bigscreenvideo.com.au to see how BSV can bring your space to life.
Welcome to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
My name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories brought to you by Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. When you stop and think of the truly inspiring West Australians, many would think of my next guest, a pioneer in her field of medicine. She became a household name, unfortunately, during a time of crisis, a crisis that is about to mark its 20-year anniversary. The bombs that shook Bali claimed 202 lives, including 88 Australians. Many of the injured found themselves in Perth needing emergency burns treatment, and they were fortunate to have the skills of Professor Fiona Wood there waiting for them. Her career, though, has been about much more than that one terrible episode. She's been an innovator in burns and reconstructive treatment. She heads the Fiona Wood Foundation. She's been an Australian of the Year, and she's a mum to six kids. Her life story has just been laid out in a new book called Under Her Skin. But for the next hour or so, I'm going to try to get under hers a little bit. Professor Fiona Wood, hello, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Tim. Thank you very much.
20 years. Can you believe it? I'm sure there are people who feel that every day. They still walk around with the horrible memories and the physical scars from that terrible time in Bali. But 20 years, does it feel like 20 years to you?
It's like everything, isn't it? Sometimes you think, oh, it's gone in a flash, and other times it's like, whoa, that's a long time. And a lot has happened, and, you know, we've been able to do a lot. And so I think time is all about how much energy you put into it a bit as well, isn't it? But certainly, yeah. 20 years on, you just look back at that sort of waste of life and that suffering and those that still do, you know. So it's sobering, that's for sure.
Do you remember where you were when you got that call that people were coming your way, that this shocking thing had happened in Bali and that you may be busy for quite a while from here on?
Yes, I mean, I was at home getting ready to go to a wedding at King's Park, and Vij and Preya, our plastics registrar at the time, and his wife, who was an anaesthetist, were actually over in Bali, and they had contacted us because they were in Sengala Hospital, so we knew very early on that Sunday morning that there was a big problem and that our skills would be needed.
And so were you ready? Did you feel like you were ready for what you were about to do?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think as the world watched how we responded, not just here in Western Australia, but across the whole of the country, we were prepared, yes. We had done a whole lot of exercises and planning. And it's interesting to reflect on how that all started, with the CEO of Woodside in the late 1990s, contacting us and asking how we would respond if there was an explosion on the Northwest Shelf. And we worked collaboratively, and they funded, Woodside that is, funded the whole development of an Ausburn plan, which went across the whole country. We were collaborated with the Commonwealth has brought the states together, the Australian New Zealand Burns Association, all those sort of dedicated multidisciplinary teams across the country, and with the Defence Force, etc. So we put together a very robust plan. Woodside funded an exercise called Exercise Icarus, and we all flew around in helicopters and did all sorts of things and learned how the plan could work and could work better, which was more the point. And then we put that plan to the Health Minister's Advisory Council in July of 2002, and they accepted the recommendations that we had put forward in August. And in part of that was another planned exercise. So we would expand the exercise across the country, but we never did that because, of course, we did it for real in October. And so, yes, our education and training was such that that's what we were trained for. But I felt very fortunate that we'd had the experience and that sort of good fortune to work with Woodside in the years preceding, so that we had got very robust systems in place.
Yeah, amazing timing in hindsight. Mm. October 12, 2002, it wasn't far away from that period you're talking about. When October 12 comes up on the calendar this year, Fiona, and it's 20 years, and a lot of people will be reflecting on that time, what are the standout memories for you that will occupy your mind on October 12?
I think it's interesting because, you know, on one hand, I feel that profound loss and that grief for all those who suffered so badly and continue to do so. But on the other hand, it was a real privilege to work at that time when everybody's pulling together, and we were able to do an extraordinary amount of work at that time to treat everybody as if they were here as individuals. And 3 weeks after the sort of 12th of October, one of my colleagues, Ian Goller, who's a paediatric burn surgeon at the time, said, we've lived through something special here, you know, where everybody, the whole community has been behind us. The whole community has supported what we've been doing. And it was a unique period of time in my life.
In terms of being on the wards themselves, can you take us inside the burns unit? I mean, what was it like? Was it absolute chaos? Was it quiet? I mean, you would have had sections of the media camped outside as well, loved ones, relatives. Everyone was sort of focused, for quite a lot of that period after October 12 on you and your work and your team. I mean, what was it like inside that that pressure cooker?
Well, the burns unit was designed to for serial expansion, if you like, to accommodate such a situation. Our 9 beds expanded it into another 4 beds of plastic surgery and so on. We opened the doors, and so we spread along the corridor, and then we isolated areas for the media, for loved ones. And the same in the intensive care unit. We isolated the patients from the rest of the patients. And in the operating theatre, we used specific operating theatres isolated from the rest of the work that was going on. And so as part of the planning, we established all the cordoned off the areas. And in areas where we were able to look after people who were waiting whilst their loved ones were in surgery, and while they were having dressings and physio, etc. And then we started putting people together, like the 4 German boys were in one room together, and they were always playing cards and having a good time as they recovered, you know. And a lot of them were young, like they were young folks, and, you know, so there was a fair bit of banter as people started to recover. So, yes, it was quiet to begin with, a level of tension in the air. But as the days rolled by and people started to, they had that relief on their face that they'd arrived and they got here. And then the days, as I say, they're getting better and better. And, you know, they're sort of understanding that they are going to come through this. And so then the banter starts to increase. And so then, you know, yeah, we're on the road. We're on the road to the finish line, though it's not always straight road, that's for sure. It's a bit of a roller coaster with burn injury, but there was that sort of feel of collegiality, is the word, is it? You know, that we were all in it together. You know, the patients, the teams, our team had expanded, of course, and so that feeling that we were all in this together was very strong.
Yeah. We've been certainly hearing that phrase a lot lately.
Yes.
In a completely different context. But you,
yes. Well, it was funny.
You genuinely meant it and felt it back then. Fiona, obviously, it was a massive success, the work that you're able to do there post the bombings. But the unfortunate reality is that not everyone makes it. How do you deal with those losses along the way? How do you price them as a surgeon?
I think we interrogate very aggressively the situations where our patients don't survive. And over the years, there are those who don't. It's really very obvious that the injury is overwhelming, and they will succumb within 24, 48 hours. And then there's those who we will try absolutely have everything, 100% full on. But over the days, it becomes apparent that they haven't got the capacity to respond to this enormous injury. And so they succumb at about around a week. And then another third of our patients in this space will survive some months and then succumb usually to overwhelming infection. And that was the pattern that we had in Bali, post-Bali. We had a patient who died within the first couple of days, one at the end of the week, and then 56 days. And learning all the time to make sure that we can reduce that suffering in the future is certainly the way I've coped over the years. It's always trying to learn to be to somehow do better next time.
Just before we leave Bali for a moment and talk about other things, Fiona, if Bali happened today, would the response and your response be massively different to what we saw in 2002?
I don't think so. I think we have a level of capacity across this whole country. I think we have we can respond. I think we've demonstrated that throughout COVID. I think yes, there's been an element of butting up into that space of being overwhelmed in that pandemic sense, but certainly I think we have got the capacity to respond. And we've got the technology and the know-how. So I firmly believe that what you do in a disaster is what you do every day. You just need the extra hands, the extra bodies. And so we have surge capacity, body systems, basic trainings, and all those things in place. So, yes, I think we would be able to respond.
Fiona, we're going to take a break now. After that, though, I really want to get into your early years from the north of England in a relatively small town in a fifth-generation coal mining family. How on earth did your story start there and continue here? So there's a lot to fill in. Fiona Wood is our special guest on Inspiring Stories. Back with more right after this.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. We are with Professor Fiona Wood, National Living Treasure. She's just got a new book that's come out called Under Her Skin. But we have an opportunity at the moment to find out a little bit more about Fiona Wood's life in this episode of Inspiring Stories. Fiona, you're from the north of England, from the Yorkshire area, in a family of fifth-generation coal miners. It almost sounds something like, out of a Dickens novel or something, doesn't it? But tell me, what do you remember of your early years in England?
Well, it's cold in the north of England, getting dressed in bed because it was too cold to get out. I think it was at the time when the opportunity for education was really building, I think. So it's not so Dickensian as it could have been. So that opportunity for education was key. Mum and Dad had left school as young teenagers and, at that 13, 14 age and gone into the workforce. And so they were very focused that we would get an education. And, the phrase was, the mantra was, you get up, education will give you the choice to get up in the morning and enjoy what you do. And, my dad didn't enjoy going down the coal mine, that's for sure. And so getting up in the morning and doing a job that you enjoy was really the focus. And in order to do that, you had to work hard. And as I say, education gave you the choice. And so my life really changed when I went to a Quaker school at 13. And that was in a nearby village that we subsequently moved to because my mother got a job at the school. And it was life-changing. It gave me the opportunity to go through to year 12 and on to university. I was accelerated through school. And so I really engaged in that the whole experience, to be perfectly honest. And as a young teenager, you're so influenced by what's going on around you, aren't you? And the Quakers were very, very community-minded, very community-spirited. There was a lot of community service as part of what we were doing at school. And the school motto was non sibi sed omnibus, not for yourself, but for others. And so it certainly left a mark.
You found yourself gravitating towards plastic surgery, particularly working with cleft palate and conditions like that. Of all of the many and wide varieties of specialised medicine you could go into, why did that grab your interest?
Well, right from the word go, as I've kicked in at med school, I was going to be a surgeon, and then I was looking around, and I did a BMed Sci in neuroanatomy, sort of brain anatomy, and anthropology, and how the brain developed with our bodies developing into, you know, from four legs to two legs and all that sort of thing. And so I was interested in the brain, and I thought, oh, is that a space? And then I got the opportunity to do research with the plastic surgeons, doing anatomical dissections in order to understand how we could move pieces of tissue so that we, under the microscope, you can reattach that tissue. And so by doing the anatomical dissections for them, I became, you know, at the very bottom rung of the research team, and I was able to go into theatre and watch what they were doing. And plastic surgery is very creative. It's like problem solving on the go, and there's, you've got all these different techniques that are being developed all the time, and so how do they all come together to give the best possible reconstruction for that person's trauma, cancer, congenital defect, or burn injury. And so that's how I got sort of sucked into that. And certainly the children and some of the, like the clefts and some of those congenital problems was a real interest for a very long time. Still is, actually. I think it's fascinating how we can rebuild people in those circumstances.
And tell us about the skin. Why is the skin so intriguing to you?
Oh, I think it's, yeah, I think it's part of the nervous system. You know, it does so many things. It keeps us, you know, it controls our temperature, and it's clearly involved in our emotional responses because we blush and all. You know, it's protective from the sunlight. It's a barrier for bacteria, evaporative water loss. You know, I could go on. I could talk about skin till you turn to dust, you know. And I think understanding its multiple functions is really important when you're trying to rebuild it, and understanding how complex the organ is. And certainly out of necessity, sometimes we think of it in a simplistic layer, like an outproof water layer and a tough inner layer. And if we can fix that, then that's good enough. But that's never good enough. What's good enough is the regeneration, the skin of that person's body site of that at that time. And so I think, you know, the first thing I realized was the scarring can be so extreme, and the scarring isn't just what it looks like, it's how it feels, how it moves. And, you know, we talk about the physical scar, absolutely, but the psychological scar, how that's impact you know, in the mental health space with that person, and changes their function, not just physically but mentally. And then we've done research more recently in how burn injury, particularly, and trauma can influence the way people respond to other circumstances subsequently, many years afterwards. So there's a scar in the physiology on the inside of folks, and trying to unravel all that so that we could treat it better has become clearly the passion.
Humans, it seems, I don't know if I'm getting overly philosophical here and perhaps erroneously, but we have an interesting relationship with our skin, don't we? We want to pierce it, we want to tattoo it, we want to morph it into, you know, something that makes us look younger. Some people burn it intentionally by leaving ourselves out in the sun too much. Do you sometimes see the way people interact with their own skin? There's only skin that we have, and just sort of shake your head and wonder what we're doing with it.
Well, I think I've been a doctor over 40 years now, you know, I've been around the traps long enough to know that your decisions are yours. And what I do is I bring to the table the capacity to help in whatever way I can, no judgment, because everybody is influenced by their genes and their environment and make decisions. And so some the tattooing that we see these days is just leaves me like cold, you know. It's like, why? But you know, it's clearly very popular, so maybe it's me that's missing something.
I'm guessing that you haven't got any tattoos or piercings in Fiona.
well yeah, I've got I'm quite fond of pearl earrings. But that's about as far as it goes.
What about your children, dare I ask? Have they come to you and said, "Mum, I'm thinking about getting a tattoo"?
No, no, my kids are clean skins.
They wouldn't dare.
I think it'd be interesting. And I've got one of my nephews plays professional rugby league, and he stands out on the pitch because he's a clean skin. Yeah, because he hasn't. And he goes, "Oh, I'm too wussy to get the needles."
And you would back him on that 100%,
yes.
I'm sure. Just speaking of sporting prowess, there has always been this cute story that goes within your story, Fiona, about your Olympic aspirations as an athlete, as a child. But we've spoken about this before, and it's a nice story, but you've sort of told me that it was never really a reality. That story has stayed with you, though, hasn't it?
I know, you go, be careful what you say, haven't you? I wanted to be an astronaut as well, but that didn't stick. I'm very focused on sport as part of, from a whole societal perspective. I think it's a fundamental part of what we should use to in our wellness and health paradigm and all. But certainly as a kid, I was inspired by a couple of women who were much older than me, but coached me, Val Wild and Dorothy Hyman, and they'd both been to the Olympics. They'd got on an aeroplane, left the mining village and gone to the Olympics in Mexico and Tokyo, actually. And so that was inspiring to see that these young women had done that as I was a kid. And so I think, I want to, wow, wouldn't it be amazing? Absolutely. Was I good enough? Absolutely not, So you've got to be realistic here and there.
Tell us what brought you to Australia, because obviously you started your career over in the UK. At what point did you decide, I'm going to move to the other side of the world and continue there?
I think that's, I gave that, probably very not the thought I should have. I was doing general surgical fellowship exams, and I met a West Australian, and I'd known him 3 weeks when we decided to get married. We got married the first weekend we both had off our rosters, which was 10 weeks later, and that's 37 years ago now. And he said, "You marry me, you live in Perth, and that's not Scotland, and it's non-negotiable." And I remember at the time thinking, whatever. And because at the time we were both very involved in the English training system, but he was right. 2 years later, when I had my eldest boy and the little five-week-old babe, we did come because it was non-negotiable. And so in November 87, we landed here. And I remember when his Prof Tony House said, contacted Tony, said, "It's about time you came home and carried your training on here." He said, I said it was non-negotiable. I sort of shrugged and thought, okay, give it a go. And that was with the insight of a gnat, I found myself here. And I'd have to say, I was in the water this morning at City Beach, and I just still think, how blessed I am to have found myself in such an amazing place.
Yeah. Do you ever wonder what life might have been like had you not followed that instruction or not met in the first place?
Absolutely. It's just, it's weird, isn't it? That sort of sliding doors moments in your life. And I'm just very grateful for many things. I mean, that's trivial saying I love living by the beach, and because I've been very supported in the whole community in Western Australia. But, met and married Tony. We've got six amazing kids, and I just think I am just so blessed.
And lived an amazing life here, which we're going to get into in more detail right after we take a break, Fiona. This is Inspiring Stories. Professor Fiona Wood is our special guest, back with more of her story after this.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Barra O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Barra O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. We have an Australian of the Year as our special guest in this episode. And 6 years running, she was voted Australia's most trusted person. Professor Fiona Wood, I can see you cringe when I say that. Most trusted person. How did you go taking that award on?
It's not something I was asked about, that's for sure. It was the Reader's Digest, but I think it was like one of the more random things that's happened to me.
And what happened on the seventh year? Were you not trustworthy anymore?
I think they stopped doing it. I think it got boring.
Look, one of the things that was happening in your life around about the time that you were awarded the Australian of the Year and most trusted, and countless other awards as well. There are so many. Was when people first got to know this spray-on skin concept that you're a part of. I mean, it sounds simple enough, you know, for my non-medical mind. You know, oh, skin cells in a can, you spray them on, bingo, where you go. But obviously, there's a lot more to it than that. How does spray-on skin work?
Well, there is. It's not in a can either. It's on a syringe.
No.
So it's much more medical. Yeah. Well, but the story for me starts in the 80s. As a young doctor, when I was in England watching the sort of technology where people was trying to take a piece of skin from a non-injured area and grow a skin sheet, because we were skin grafters, and so sheets seemed a reasonable way to go. And so that's where the story starts for me, is the technology was first used in Boston. It came out of Mass General, Harvard, all those, the very clever fellows over there. And so I heard on the radio in 1990, when I was here as a young trainee, that Joanne Padalecki and Prof. John Masterton had been from Melbourne, from Monash, because they're scientists, and the Prof was the head of the Victoria Burns Unit. And they'd gone to Boston, learned how to do it, and brought this technology back. And so we were able to engage with Melbourne, send skin over there. And after the first few patients, it became really obvious that to me that there was a huge potential. And I was processing the skin as it was coming back from Melbourne in the bone marrow laboratories, which was in the basement of Royal Perth Hospital, because that was where the environment was appropriate to harvest cells in a very clean and sterile environment. And so that's where I met Marie Stoner. We got our heads together and we figured that, you know, we could do it differently, we could do it faster. And, you know, to grow a skin cell sheet in those days, and many places around the world still do that, use that technology, takes 3 weeks. And so we put together a grant and we applied for Telethon funding. And so all those mums and dads and Telethon in 1993 gave us the funds to start the laboratory. And we cleared out a store cupboard on Hay Street at PMH. And there's a picture of Marie and I just outside where the lab was when we built it. And of course, the hospital's been pulled down now, all gone. And so we worked out how to grow the sheets in 10 days. And then we were experimenting and understanding that, yeah, the sheets were hard to use and to integrate. And so they kind of blistered off and caused a bit of, you know, painful sores and things. And where you got that painful sore, took longer to heal, so the scar was worse. But then we saw that when the sheets were immature, paradoxically, they did better. And we started exploring this to the point where we harvested the cells in the laboratory when they were still in suspension, before they connected to each other to make a sheet. And then we sort of thought, well, we've got this soup. How do we get this kind of soup on? And we made blisters with dressings, and it was all very, you know, we're trying to work out how to keep this, get the fluid on that would contain the cells onto the surface. And one of us just said, oh, we should spray this on. We're not sure which one, but we sort of disappeared down Rockaby Road to the art store, the pharmacy, to the anaesthetic trolley in the hospital, and we got every way we could spray. And we did a lot of experiments with different spraying, airbrushing and all that. And we found a nozzle that was on an Italian mouth freshener, and we can clip that on a 5 mil syringe. And it's got the right internal workings. It's got vortex in an aperture that as you push the fluid through, the cell, 90% plus viability coming through the system, and the cells are functional. So that's the nozzle that's still used around the world. It comes from
an Italian mouthwash product.
Yes. And so, but we don't have the mouthwash anymore. We just get the nozzles. And so then we thought, well, what about taking the basic elements of the tissue culture lab actually to the bedside? And so what we did was we got the key elements and we put it in a box, and we ended up building and manufacturing a medical device, a point-of-care medical device, which is called RECELL. And so we put the skin in the device, in the enzyme, and it takes about 30 minutes, and we can spray the skin cells directly back on. So we've taken the laboratory to the bedside, and actually it's given us the flexibility. So we use it in association with salvaging in the burn wound so we can resurface if we can keep parts of the skin there. And then we use it with traditional grafts and with different scaffolds. So it's part of our toolbox of what we use. And so it's been since 1995, 96, it's been part of what we do. So when it came to Bali and the window to our world opened and people said, oh, you're doing things differently. Yes, but not today. We've been doing this for some years. And so it was part of our journey.
Can I ask what might be a really dumb question, but the cells themselves that you're cultivating, where have they come from?
Oh, from, my apologies, that come from an area of you that's not injured, as close as possibly matched.
From the same, so from the person.
From you to you, yes. So if your face is burnt or injured, we would take it from behind your ear, so it's the closest site match. We could take from the sole of the foot to put on the palm of the hand, that kind of thing. But most frequently, we take it from the bottom or the back of the thigh, and that would go on to arms, legs, and torso. So the skin, I mean, skin's different over the whole body surface, isn't it? And it retains the characteristics of the site of origin. So you have to match, and using the resole gives you opportunity to match it closer than we can with traditional techniques.
So using someone else's skin cells to then treat your own wound, it just wouldn't take?
Well, in some circumstances you can do it temporarily to buy you time. So we sometimes use what we call allograft, but we don't use that here, but that is used around in some places. And it just buys you time, but it will be rejected and it will come off. And so, and then you have to graft secondarily. We would use different sort of scaffolds instead of that sort of technology.
Being part of something like Spray on Skin, Fiona, in terms of the moments that make you really proud throughout your career, is this it?
Well, I think it's interesting because I look at the kit and it's, you know, it's got plastic molding, electronics, enzyme, it's biologic because it's got enzyme in it. It's, you know, that's all the forceps, the nozzle, the syringes. So it's a real, like, a little sort of lab in a box. And I look at that and I think, how did we do that? Yeah, Marie, I was at my place not that long ago. How did we do that? But, you know, we were passionate and we were driven and we did. And I learned a lot along the way. But it's just like this week we've been doing a lot of experiments with a robotic 3D printer. So what we're trying to do now, it's the journey continues. What we're trying to do now is not just deliver the skin cells of you back to you, so from a non-injured area into the wound area, but we're trying to spray on the framework so that when the cells get in there, then they start to grow and grow into new skin. And so we're in the lab working really hard on this at the moment, and we're using different printers and different bio inks to try and figure out where the sweet spot is, which is exciting because that gives us the opportunity not just to resurface the skin, but to build the whole construct.
Wow. So you're printing out the scaffolding and effectively sheets of skin. Well, out of a printer.
Well,
if I can put it that crudely.
Well, some people do the sheets of skin out of a printer in the lab, but what we're trying to do is actually directly onto the body.
Right.
And so we instead of having a sheet, which you've got to surgically fix, we'll print into all those nooks and crannies of the wound, and it will flow into the wound to the correct shape, three-dimensional shape. I mean, we're not there yet. Lots of work to do. But we're making a lot of progress.
But it's on the horizon.
Yeah.
Have you been someone who's interested in science fiction over the years?
Yes.
Fiona? And those moments where science fiction kind of then intersects with reality?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating how some sci-fi writers can... how did they think of that, you know? So, no, I think it's... I love sci-fi. And I often say that Luke Skywalker gets blown away by the stormtroopers and they put him in a Bacta tank and he regenerates. I just wonder back to tech.
See, your movie experience is probably quite different to some of the others then. So what's next on the horizon? What's sort of the next holy grail you then in burns treatment?
Well, I think there's an awful lot going on at the moment. And we've got one of the grants, we've got an HMRC grant, which is our major competitive granting bodies, is to look at how we can use transcranial magnetic stimulation. That basically means we're putting magnets and stimulating the brain so we can stimulate brain plasticity to improve outcome. And so what we're doing is based on previous work, we've seen that people who have a more plastic brain can improve quicker. So, and this techniques are used in stroke rehabilitation. It's used in depression now. And so now we're seeing if we can explore that to drive an improved outcome, which is, it links with all our exercise program and, you know, resistance exercise and a whole raft of work that we've done around that space that you never stay still, and visualization with a mirror box where you put your injured hand in a box and you move your good hand in a mirror and your brain thinks both hands are normal. You know, it's that sort of neurological interface work is something we're really driving. We're also driving something called the iKnife, which is an intelligent knife that will give us information of the chemistry, the molecules in the skin as we're cutting through it.
And you've had to do all of this and continue to do all of this while balancing lots of other things in your life as well, namely being a mum to six, Fiona, which I'll get you to talk more about right after we take a break. This is Inspiring Stories. Professor Fiona Wood is our guest. Back with more right after this.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bara O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bara O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Tim McMillan is my name. My special guest is the very inspiring Professor Fiona Wood, burns treatment pioneer here in Western Australia, and her skills have been replicated right around the world. Fiona, we've talked already about some of the extraordinary career highlights for you. You're also a mum to six. Just from my vantage point, I'm guessing you're a very, very busy lady.
It was funny. I was at a function a few weeks ago with my brother, who's a professor of orthopedics, and we were talking to medical students about careers in surgery. And when I was asked this question, he jumped up. He said, "I'm answering this." And he said, it's no surprise that two of her boys ended up doing a spell in the military. They were kind of used to it. And so I got a lot of razzing. But yeah, there was a military, like, organization is important. Keeping them busy was important, working together. So after a period of time where we had babysitters at home, then the kids came to us when Michelle, our last babysitter, said she was moving on and starting a photography business with her husband Craig. And they said, you know, we don't need another babysitter. We don't want to break anybody else in. We just need a driver. So they were okay. So by then, they were all at school by then. And so we changed our, I sort of worked early. My husband did the early runs and I did the after school. But we extended the school day with sport before and after. So they've all represented WA in various things, and a couple have represented Australia. And so there's probably because they're made to do it all the time. Yeah, but I'm very fortunate. Yeah, they're a great crew, and now I've got four grandkids too. It's just very special.
Wow. You know that you've set the bar impossibly high for those kids. You know, two medical professionals for parents. You know, what hope did they have for you? Disappointing you.
No, the only deal is they get up in the morning and enjoy what they do, that they contribute. And I'm very fortunate they do. You know, my daughter, my eldest daughter's just finished up plastic surgery training. And the others are in various other fields. But they're all contributing and living the dream, you know, so it's really good.
How do you feel about that, about, you know, really closely following your footsteps?
It's interesting because, you know, it is very close, and sometimes I feel I can be really helpful and sometimes I feel like I'm just in the way. So, but we are very close, all of us. And so it's, we've all felt her journey along the way.
Yeah.
They work hard, and her siblings have supported her along the way as well, because they know what it's like because they've lived it with their mum and dad, you know.
And what do you do to just switch off and chill out if you ever get that opportunity?
I guess over the years, I think sort of exercise and fitness has been a big part of our lives, and I think, you know, if you're fit, you can actually function at a higher level, so that matters as well. So riding my bike, going in the ocean every morning, exercise has been a big part of it. But I think it's interesting because my life was so focused on the kids when I wasn't working that as they've grown up and moved on, then I'm looking for other things to do. And so I've started taking lessons in making jewellery, and I'm really enjoying learning new skills.
Making jewellery?
Yeah,
wow.
It's really good. And I really enjoy it because I don't think about work for 4 hours a week. It's great. But then when I go on a long bike ride, I come back and all I've been thinking about is work. But that's great too, because I love it.
The Fiona Wood Foundation, when an established foundation like that bears your name, there's probably a certain extra pressure and extra motivation for you to do extraordinary things with the Fiona Wood Foundation. What have you got on your horizon there? What's your priority there?
Well, it's interesting because when we first started, Marie and I, that was the Macomb Foundation. And
yes.
As Harold Macomb is a great mentor of mine. And then the team changed more recently as we're moving into our sort of the future plans. And Mark Fear is the scientist I work with now. And we've been looking at the future plans. And one of the opportunities we've got right now is with the University of Western Australia if we can find $3 million, then they will match that $3 million and we will have a professor's position in perpetuity. That means we will have a professor in burns research forever. And that's a real key part of this whole jigsaw going forward. That can never be stopped, that will be always there. And so that will be an absolute cornerstone around which the research will follow and be built around that. So that's a really important piece of work that we're driving for, because the Research Foundation, Macomb, and then more latterly, the Fiona Wood Foundation, has given us an opportunity for people to support us and for us to keep going consistently for over 30 years. In this space, adding to the body of knowledge, putting our work out there internationally, being able to collaborate internationally and learn where the next opportunity is, and driving that care, always learning from today to make tomorrow better, is really fundamentally the one thing that's kept me awake over the years is how can we pay the researchers? And it's hard. And so to have this opportunity to have a senior significant position sort of nailed, if you like, is a really huge step forward. And as I say, I'd just like to say thank you because many people in WA and beyond have supported us to this point, and it's made it possible.
Is it annoying or frustrating to you that you, as someone who is all about the science, has to spend so much of your mental energy focusing on the dollars?
I'm a great optimist, and it's how you take to the table. So, using it as the opportunity to instill the passion in science and instill the passion of energy for positive gain, and to build the community is how I've sort of framed it in my mind, so that people are part of our team. The people that support us are part of our team, and we can't do it without. And so when you look at it like that, then to go and to speak at Rotary meetings or sporting groups or anywhere that will stay still long enough for me to talk, it's worthwhile because it's spreading the energy as well.
Yeah. Well, people are going to know a lot more about your story from this point on, Fiona, because you've got this book out, Under Her Skin. What's that been like? Just to finish off, what's it actually been like sitting down with someone else, in this case, Sue Matthews, the author, and bearing all for this in-depth look at your life? What has that been like for you to go through that process?
Harrowing, excruciating, but also a lot less painful than I thought. Because I have great people around me. Poor Sue will speak to me, and then she's done a lot of research and has spoken to lots and lots and lots of people, because I was so overwhelmed by the whole concept to begin with, and I thought, I'll just go and ask them, just go and ask them. and so she has, from all through, tracked my journey and put it into the context of the history at the time. And so I think that's made it easier for me when I've had to read the bits, and that's like, it's really quite confronting reading about yourself. But it's it puts it, in, as I say, in the context of the history at the time, makes it, in my mind, more interesting because it's there's other threads going through there. And I'd have to say, Dai, who runs the foundation, Dai Lim, has been astonishing at bullying me into doing it. And my friend, Claire Kuzic, who's been astonishing because she'd known me since we were in London together a long time ago. And she is a great proofreader. But it, again, it's all about sustainability into the future. The funds from the book will go to the foundation, like the royalties from the sales resale go to the foundation. For me, yep. The IP is all about being able to do the research tomorrow. That's the worth of this for me.
All for a good cause then. And it's a fantastic read.
Oh, thank you.
Fiona, thank you so much for giving us some insight into your life. As I say, if you want to get to much more in-depth, Under Her Skin is out now. So we look forward to the many more achievements and incredible breakthroughs that you'll no doubt make over the rest of your career. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks very much for your kindness, Tim.
Thank you. You've been listening to Inspiring Stories here on 882 6PR. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. We look forward to you joining us next time as we unearth another inspiring story.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Life's busy. Take this deck. There's heaps to do on it, like polishing off this wine. That's tough. Life's pretty good with a Trex deck. Composite decking with no hard maintenance. Trex, the world's number one decking brand.